Calling all pregos, you are not going to want to miss this. In this week's episode, I talk with the incredible Anne Gilligan, labor and delivery nurse and creator of Gilligan's Guide, which teaches pregnant women and providers specific maternal positioning in order to optimize the baby's position for a smooth vaginal birth. There was so much in this episode that I was absolutely lit up by, and I am so excited by this information. I highly recommend looking into working with Anne and taking her course if you're wanting to learn more, because I truly feel this is the type of revolutionary information that we will see widely spread amongst all birth professionals in due time. Sit back and have a listen. You are going to learn a lot.
Welcome to Healthy as a Mother, the podcast for becoming and being a mother, with your co-hosts, Dr. Leah Gordon and Dr. Morgan McDermott, two naturopathic doctors who get it.
Each week, we teach you how to be the healthiest mother you can be, from fertility and preconception to pregnancy and birth prep, through postpartum and throughout motherhood, empowering you with the natural health guidance and education you're not getting elsewhere, so you can confidently navigate the broken system at large.
The real, the raw, the untalked about. And remember, this information is not intended to diagnose, treat, or manage any disease. Always consult with your doctor before making any changes.
Okay, welcome Anne to the podcast today. I'm so excited to have you. And for anybody who doesn't know Anne Gilligan, she teaches the Gilligan's Guide course webinar algorithm, if you will. It's a lot of different things. She can teach it to, you know, doulas or health professionals. Can lay people take the class as well?
Yeah, I have my own clients.
Yes, that's right. You have your own, yes, your own individual clients, which is actually so brilliant because you as an individual pregnant person can take the class and know how to do it between you and your partner, or maybe take the class with your doula, et cetera. And the whole entire thing is about optimal fetal positioning. So before we kind of dive in, Anne, can you just tell us about yourself and how you began to develop the guide or see the need to develop the guide?
Sure. Thanks for having me. It's such an honor to be on your podcast, and I'm excited to be able to talk today about maternal positioning for optimal fetal positioning. The overview of kind of how I started was my background entails about 34 years now, going on 35 years. I've been doing this. I started in 1988, starting into OB. I graduated in 89, so I had this kind of pre-job working in a hospital in the OB unit before I even graduated. So I have many years experience. I also along the way became a sexual assault nurse examiner, and the legal side interests me. So I do still today and took an in-house job being a legal nurse consultant. Prenatal yoga is very important. I'm a yogi. I do yoga daily. And so I became an instructor for that. And then evidence-based birth instructor is really, I take great pride in being a part of Rebecca Decker's evidence-based birth. So if you don't know about that, please check it out. So I decided, well, I've always been interested in maternal positioning ever since the very beginning. And then lately, I have realized the problem of the rising cesarean rate in our country. It's now at 32%. And when I first started working, it was right about 10, 11%. So it's more than tripled in the amount of time that I have become this a nurse in this obstetric world of ours. So I saw there was a problem most recently with that rising C-section rate. Vaginal births were also becoming very difficult. And it wasn't such a fun and easy job that I had in the early 90s. So I realized there was a problem. I have always believed in the pregnant body and how, and when you move and when you use gravity, that things will move along. And so I've always kind of just kind of tinkered around with suggesting different positions for my clients in the hospital. And many attempts later, the guide, Gilligan's guide, the algorithm of four maneuvers kind of came together. And I would say it's been about 5 years now that I've been using the guide. What it is four positions that the pregnant person gets in, and you do it in sequence, and you do it while you're at the place of birth while on the fetal monitor. And as you said, I train pregnant people at about 34 weeks. And then I train many, many doulas, many providers. I've gone to medical schools. I've gone into clinics and taught family practice docs, obstetricians while they're still in training. And even after many, many years of working on a unit, I will take on the whole group and talk to them about the physiological birth. And what I realized 5 years ago was it needed to be done. There needed to be a solution to the problem, and that many people around me weren't addressing the problem. They were just kind of dealing with the outcome. So say we're going to figure out more ways to treat postpartum hemorrhage. We're going to develop a policy and a procedure in order to treat postpartum hemorrhage. But I'm on the other end saying, let's prevent the postpartum hemorrhage.
Love Let's that. Prevent, yes.
Preventative medicine is the best way to do things. So
yes.
It's always the best approach. So let's prevent that postpartum hemorrhage in the first place. Let's keep them from needing to use Pitocin, from going on, 12, 24, 36 hours of labor, which puts them in that box of having a postpartum hemorrhage. So I just realized that it needed to be done. So COVID gave us Zoom, which has been incredibly helpful in my business. And I've talked to people all over the world and continue to hear from people all over the world that want to learn how to optimize the fetal position antenatally at 34, starting at 34 weeks, doing some things using the Gilligan's homework, and then while in labor at your place of birth, using the guide. Although I do teach you what to do while you're in early labor too, that does not involve the guide, based on principles that I can talk about today too.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you so much. So just so to delineate and say it again for people, the Gilligan's homework. So your last name is Gilligan. This is why this name comes about. Yeah. The Gilligan's homework is a set of different kinds of prenatal movements to be doing. It's not quite like spinning babies, although a lot of that people will be familiar with that. It's more just, keeping the baby, keeping your body open, balanced, your hips, etc. Starting at 34 weeks up until you go into labor. Gilligan's guide then is not to be performed outside of being in the realm of where you're at for your labor. So if you're having a home birth, that means that you're at home, but also the baby's being monitored, because one of the points that I really appreciated that you made was about baby's safety. And, not that you've had anything happen necessarily, but it's always important to monitor baby's heart rate when we're going to be changing their positioning because of the way that maybe, they're laying on the cord or different heart rate decels, different things like that, that can be happening in the context of, labor also happening. And because sometimes when you get baby into the right position, things happen very quickly, which is, the way that when we think about this historically from where we've come from, this is one thing I love to think about and ponder, because I was an anthropology minor and I just believe so very much in science and life and humans and all sorts of species, that it cannot possibly be that our labors are meant to be so difficult and so long and, so painful and just all of the things that seem to be happening or needing so much medical intervention. And yes, we are living differently for sure. And that's a huge component. But it's like the physiological labor, meaning the way that the birth would happen undisturbed, unpoked, even, I always bring this up, but like even the farmer knows not to disturb the animal that's in labor, because things get messed up when they do, maybe with the labor or maybe with the way that a mother animal will reject its young once it comes out or not nurse it, etc. So I love just this preventative, let's get the baby in the right motion. Let's do the things with our body so that when they're in this right positioning, which means, so we're not going to get super technical here, but a lot of pregnant people will have heard the terms LOA or ROA. So left occiput anterior, right occiput anterior. Yes, there we go. So we've got a little video up here for the people that are watching on the video. What this means is that, so occiput means the back of the head, basically. And so what this means, that is an LOA baby right there. So we want the baby's back of its head to be up against your left hip. And the head is obviously down. And that is the proper position for the start of labor, because the baby has to do these movements that to navigate out of the pelvis. And when they're in that position versus being on the right side of the body, it seems like it wouldn't be that big of a deal. They're still head down, they're still facing sideways, etc. but it really does make a big deal. And why is that? Why is an ROA baby a risk for these longer labors and these different things that you've been seeing?
So there is, on the left side of the pregnant person's body, the uterine muscle, the myometrium, the shape of the uterus is actually taller on the left side. We use the term dextrorotated, so it's a little bit more turning to the right. So if you look at the uterus shape, so there's actually more space on the left side for the fetus to align its body to make it straight. So it allows the fetus to go into the inlet of the bony pelvis, your bony pelvis at the top, which we call the inlet, in a more straight fashion while tucking its chin, which enables the occiput, as you mentioned, the back of the fetal head, to enter into the inlet of the pelvis first. And what's interesting is if the baby is in on the left side going into the pelvis, that is the only way that the baby can go through the cardinal movements of birth, which we enable, which we talk about in the rotation and the extension and the descent and the internal rotation and how the baby goes through. And that is the safest, most efficient way to a vaginal delivery. We know that if the infant, and this is prima gravidis, this is first time laboring persons is what we're referring to, because when you get to be that second time laboring, your uterine shape at the bottom is actually shaped differently. So if you take the prima gravida, the first time pregnant person laboring, the bottom of the shape of the shape of the pelvis at the bottom is more pear shaped. It's smaller than the top. In a subsequent pregnancies, it's more what we call apple shaped. So it's easier for a baby to rotate from right to left if you've had a baby before. So we're going to be talking generally today about the prima gravida, about that first time, because my goal is to prevent that first primary cesarean section. We know that, when we take all the what we call VBAC, vaginal birth after cesarean facts, only 2.9% of people actually attempt a vaginal birth after two cesareans. So that is why it's so important that, number one, we avoid the first C-section. And number two, if you've had a C-section, to attempt to have that VBAC, because that success rate is like 80%. And so we know that that is your chance to have that vaginal birth if in fact you've had that cesarean section. And primarily that reason for that first C-section does have something to do with that fetal position, whether it be arrest of descent, meaning the baby is not descending, or arrest of dilatation, meaning your cervix is not dilating. That is the main cause of cesarean section at 32% in our United States. So generally, we want to prevent that C-section, that first C-section, by doing maternal positioning, getting the baby in the optimal fetal position. Anything other than the baby being on the left side with its body straight, meaning symmetrical. If it's not symmetrical, it's asymmetrical or asynclitic. So we want baby on left side with its body nice and straight. Anything other than that, say right side, right occiput transverse, or right occiput posterior, or occiput posterior means the occiput is towards the pregnant person's spine, that creates problems as the baby descends through that bony pelvis and requires interventions, right? And then we talk about what you mentioned. The more you intervene, the more you intervene. And we know that intervention is directly related to the outcome of cesarean section. So it's just a matter of let's try to prevent it by doing your homework, starting at 34 weeks. Don't worry about the position of the baby prior to that. And even so, don't worry about it even then. You have until 39 weeks pregnant to actually start thinking about where that fetal occiput is. And that is when I really would love for that fetal occiput to be on the left side, because that is going to enable the fetus to sit on that cervix and to prepare your body for birth.
Okay. So I have a couple
of
questions.
Lots of goals.
Yeah. This is amazing. This is so smart. So what is it? Okay. One quick question. Is the reason that there's more space on the left side of the uterus to do with the liver being on the right side of the body and it kind of cramping the uterus there? Or is that just always the way that a uterus is shaped?
The uterine shape and the dextral rotation of the uterus and the liver both are the reasons being. But the third reason is that typically due to the shape and the alignment of the myometrium in the uterus favors a clockwise rotation of a fetus. So on screen, again, I'll demonstrate, but I'll explain. If you've got a baby that starts out, a fetus that starts on the right side, guess which way the baby's going to rotate?
Yeah, they're going to rotate posterior. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So many times, and we know, and I can talk about epidurals later if you want, but we know that the people that have epidurals are five times more likely to have a persistent, what we mean as a something that is really hard to rotate, occiput posterior baby, because they start on the right. The baby starts on the right, and then with gravity and with that contraction pattern and rotation occurring with labor, the baby then rotates to an occiput posterior. But say you take a baby that starts on the left with the occiput on the person's left side, and the baby rotates clockwise, now you have that optimal position of a baby in an occiput anterior, the face facing down towards that maternal spine,
That is so cool that there's so many ways that the body really tries to get the baby into this proper positioning. And even then with the contractions, it's not like they're just squeezing uniformly and squeezing just like a tube of ketchup or something. They're squeezing with a bit of a rotated pattern. And
yes,
so smart. It's so smart and so beautiful. So then that leads me to my next question. Why do you think it's happening that so many babies are on the right side? Because you said something in the course that I just took with you recently, which if you are at all interested in this, I highly recommend it. I am kind of kicking myself that I didn't take it years ago. In retrospect, looking at my first birth, you know, you just don't know what you don't know. I mean, I guess you hadn't developed the guide 7 years ago anyways, but it would have been so key because I know he was posterior. I think he was on the right in the beginning. And at some point in labor, he was mostly posterior. The back labor was incredible. I was stop, start labor pattern. I was at 9 centimeters for like 6 hours at one point, you know, and I did end up having a home birth and everything was fine, but just man, like it, I really feel like it didn't need to be that way. He was 9 pounds, 3 ounces. People loved to tell me that it was because he was big. My second baby was also 9 pounds, 3 ounces. She was born in an hour and a half. And
yeah, you could have handled it. Yes.
Yes. As my second birth, of course, now my body knew what was going on, et cetera, et cetera. But she felt light as a feather. She felt so easy. I also felt her moving, like right when she was about to crown, I felt her entire body rotate and kind of go whoop underneath my pubic bone. I like felt the whole thing happen. Whereas with my son, I felt like he was just sort of stuck in this weird position. And I was just oozing him out like with all of my muscle strength, and it was so hard and so fatiguing, and there was nothing that was like really being helped. It was like I was just crushing him out. Whereas my daughter, if anything, I couldn't even exhale fully, because that amount of pressure with an exhale was, she was coming so fast, like my body was just, she was in the exact perfect locked and loaded position and she was coming, and then when she came out she was the exact same size. I was like, wow. And I didn't tear with her. And it was just such two completely different experiences with this same size baby, which my entire time, everybody told me, well, you know, he was 9 pounds, 3 ounces. He's 9 pounds, 3 ounces. And I'm like, guys, I just don't really think that matters. That wasn't the thing. It was his positioning. So anyway, you had mentioned at one point in the webinar that I took with you that yes, when you first started in labor and delivery, women were always coming in. Babies were LOA. So in the proper position, left occiput anterior, they were 3 or 4 centimeters dilated. And within just a couple of hours, you know, they would have their babies. And these are prima gravidas. These are first time moms too. And now, you know, that kind of a story is almost unheard of. If somebody has a quick first labor, anything less than 24 hours, it's like, whoa, holy crap, That's amazing. And you, like you said, the C-section rate is so high now. There's so many complications, et cetera, et cetera. So why do you think that's happening now? Like what is it that is contributing to this sort of presentation of either an asynclitic baby, which for those that can't see on the video, an asynclitic baby means that instead of the baby's body being directly up and down, where the head is directly down and the feet are directly up towards maybe like the bottom of your rib cage, it means that they're at this angle. So it's like the head is sort of going into either your right or your left hip. And so it's just not going to be that the top of their little small part of the top of their head that's supposed to crown and you know their chin tucked, it's not positioned like that. And so we all know with those little kid toys, you know, trying to put a square peg in a round hole or something like that, it's just you're not going to be at the right angle. You need to be in the perfect angle for it all to just fall through. Yes, in time, maybe after hours and hours and hours, or if not days of contractions, baby will sort of get into the right position. But if we can prevent this from happening, if we can prevent them from hanging out in these odd positions, then we have so many more chances that everything is going to go the way that it would be meant to. Because the trajectory at which we are right now, if in another 30 years we triple our C-section rate, I mean, this is going to be ridiculous. We have to get a handle on this. So, yeah, I would love your insights on why you think this is happening and how can we kind of be aware of some of these factors.
You're right. There's no signs of it slowing down. And that is scary. And that is why I do what I do. And that is why I have trained Dr. Morgan to do what she's going to do now. She's going to take
Thanks.
this information and she's going to share it at her birth, and she's going to share it with her community. And that makes me so happy to know
Oh.
that other people are taking this information and using it and actually creating quite a stir, because when you do it at a birth and you have the outcome of this baby just, like you said, kind of slipping out. I had a patient recently that it was a prima gravida that had a 9-pound, 7-ounce baby that she never pushed. We got to the point, she called me back because I had left her birth to go home and get some sleep. And they called me back. And I'm looking at the nurse and saying, "Why aren't you pushing?" And she said, "Because she's complete on the perineum." And so she said, I just called the doctor to come in. She hasn't even given it one push yet. He came in, put on his gloves, she pushed one time, and the baby was born. First time mom, because her body was prepared, her baby was in the perfect position, and she had an intact perineum and a 9-pound, 7-ounce baby. So yes, what you said is we like to blame, right? I'm tired of the blaming. There's no shaming and no blaming. That is not okay. I had a physician come in recently and say, "You know, we've done everything we can. We broke your water, we got PICC going, we got you an epidural. There's nothing more we can do." And I'm like, "It's not about you, right? It's not about what you can do for her. It's about empowering her to know her beautiful body and know what her abilities are, and to give her, frankly, some time for things to happen and to suggest good things to her to honor that physiological birth." And
Oh, I just got chills. I
back
love
to your
that.
question, it's like, we are not to blame. I'm not blaming what's happening to the pregnant body, but let's get up. Let's stand up more. Let's, on average, 8 to 10 hours a day. We know sedentary lifestyle. So think about anatomically your body and what is happening, and physiologically what is have been not allowed as far as space, right? So two things: your gluteal muscles aren't working well, your hip flexors aren't working well, because they're being sat on, right? And they're not moving and they're not firing. So frankly, they lose their ability to work well when we're sitting on them too much. And so let's get up as a society and be more mobile, and do things like yoga and just simple walking. Things like that. And then let's listen to the baby within when you are pregnant, so you can stand up and you can create more space when that fetus is like kicking you and saying, "Hey, I need some more space here. I'm like being kicked underneath my right rib." Let's stand up, let's honor that, and let's create opportunities for that fetus to get over to the left side. And so in my homework, I say, "Okay, 30 minutes is up. You're sitting at your desk job. Wonderful. I'm lovely. I'm glad that you're working. I'm glad you're working at something you love, hopefully. But let's set the alarm and let's get up and move at 30 minutes. and particularly if the baby's moving. So maybe if the baby's still quiet at that 30-minute mark, wait and just say, okay, it has been 30 minutes, but let's wait until that baby wakes up. Drink a little something cold or move a little bit to wake the baby up, and then stand up and arms up, leaning over your desk, moving those hips, allowing that space. Because I know that with my little Franny, who's now a mother herself, I was standing up the majority of the day. I was actually at a birth the night before she was born, wiping up the floor because I like a clean surrounding after, so my mama doesn't have to look at it. And I was down on all fours wiping the floor up the night before she was born, and saw my patient walking in the hallway with my baby the next day. It was so great. But I never was sitting down outside of chatting with my peers at the desk. Occasionally, we would sit down and talk about our patients. I had a standing desk at work, a little shelf that we would narrative write. And so times have changed. And we know that it's affected physiological diseases other than birth. But my feeling is it's now affected birth. It's now affected the way in which we allow our fetuses to get in that optimal position and get engaged prior to birth. And, you know, if you think about, I'm just going to explain a little bit medically here, but the occiput anterior baby with its chin tucked going into that bony pelvis actually sets the top of its head on the cervix. So think about as you contract and your body pushes the baby down, how that cervix can dilate if it has something pushing on it, right? Versus an occiput posterior baby, the baby is looking, I say looking up towards the stars versus looking at the ground or the earth. And the pressure is put in front of the cervix. So there's no pressure even on the cervix. So how can that person dilate properly when there's really no pressure? We're made to have pressure on that cervix as we dilate. In the beginning, you don't need the pressure so much to ripen the cervix. But as you dilate completely to 10 centimeters, you really need a bag of water or the head to be pressing on it in order for that to fully dilate and go away. And so the pressure anatomically is not in the correct place. Yeah. So she is having a hard time. That arrest of dilatation is due to the fact that the baby is malpositioned. And so it's for me to talk about this and to know that professional people can't understand it is mind-boggling to me, because it is purely anatomical when it gets to be that, when you're talking about the malpositioned fetus.
I love that. Thank you so much. Yeah. So I'm 25 weeks pregnant right now and with my fourth. So, I mean, this is, you know, Yay! Not my first rodeo here. Yeah, I know. I'm so excited. And it's funny how much people, like, I'm trying to think, where was I? It's like almost anywhere I go, people see me that they're pregnant. They're like, oh, come sit down. You know, they pull out the chair for me, or they're like, if I'm carrying something, and it's nice. It's definitely totally courteous. And sometimes, you know, a pregnant person does want to sit down. They're very tired. And at the same time, like, pregnant is not a disability and
right?
We need to be moving. We need to not think, oh, I just need to lay down for the whole day. And no, absolutely not. Like you said, being on hands and knees is so important. And what I'm always telling my, you know, patients, clients, friends is, especially when you're a second or, you know, subsequent mom and you have other children, when you're picking up toys or you're cleaning something,
that's right.
Get down in a big squat, a deep squat, or get on your hands and knees, like get on the floor. Or, you know, I mean, better yet, yoga, of course, is a great thing to do. But if people aren't doing that, like just in your daily tasks, it's so easy to keep this sort of range of motion and not be afraid to, I know it's uncomfortable. I get it. Like I'm starting to feel now where I'm like, I can't completely bend in certain ways. I can't see, you know, my toes right now, that kind of stuff. And I can still get on my hands and knees. I can still squat when I'm tying my kids' shoes or doing different things instead of just bending down or having someone else do it. All of these little opportunities. And again, we have to think about ourselves adaptively, physiologically from back in time. We were never just sitting down like this. We were sitting or we were like squatting, we were moving, we were picking things, we were, you know, gardening and preparing food and taking care of children and moving around constantly. There was no luxury to be sitting the way
That's
that we
right.
are. Yeah. The sitting is the new smoking kind of thing is now infiltrating birth outcomes, and it really needs to stop. I mean, like you said about just chronic disease and all of the different things, the heart disease, the metabolic disease, obesity, et cetera. There's a lot of things here. But so if you're pregnant, you're listening to this, get up and move. And, you know, it doesn't have to be crazy. You don't have to be lifting cross weights or anything.
That's the extreme. Stretch.
Yes.
Yeah.
You
don't have to be extreme about it. And it's really, it's that easy to just get up and move. But you do have to make opportunities in today's work world. Particularly because there's a lot of women in the workforce and you do have to make opportunities. I want you to succeed with your job, and I want you to be successful and happy, but I also want you to be healthy. And to move every 30 minutes is actually the newest recommendation for diabetes and for heart conditions, is to get up and move every 30 minutes. And so I incorporated that into my guide, and we're seeing a huge success rate. I did want to mention that. You asked about my stats of, why people should be doing the guide, and in particular, the homework, is that 91% of my people, I did 45 people in 2021. I haven't added up the stats from 2022 because I haven't heard back from everybody yet. But in 2021, I saw 45 clients, and 41 of them, let me just look at this again. 41 of them went into spontaneous labor with a vaginal delivery. One of them had to be induced, and then three of them had cesarean section rate. So we have a 91% success rate by just doing lifestyle changes, which, you know, mine isn't like the golden rule. You can make your own lifestyle changes, but 91% of the people gave that fetus the opportunity to get in that optimal position, therefore helped initiate that spontaneous labor. So they didn't have to have an induction of labor, which is a form of a medical induction and an intervention that therefore we will add on to most likely once you're admitted to the hospital. So it's really proven stuff, and it's really important to do. And thanks for emphasizing that and just taking it back to, evolution. It's like we're meant to be hunters, gatherers, movers, and that's how our body is made.
Incredible. 91%. I mean, congratulations. That must feel really amazing. I wonder how you came upon this particular set of motions. Did you have kind of trial and error, different phases of the guide where you're,
Most of it's research-based on, I'm constantly looking at research. I took that one study most recently about people and their cardiac history and their diabetic history and how to improve on that, the things that they suggested based on their research. Old-timey birth books, I'm always looking at the antique 1940s, 1950s birth books when labors were at a very low C-section rate. What were they doing right? What were they encouraging? And so I really have my sheroes and my heroes of things that I've read and researched from the past. And so I just took all of that and made it into a guide and kind of thought about my own pregnancies, right? Because I've got a 31-year-old, a 29-year-old, and a 26-year-old. The 26-year-old was at the cusp of computers. So I really didn't have computers. We didn't have any telemetry at our hospital. We didn't have any computers at that point, no cell phones. I used to have to open the door up and scream, "Lori, get in here." You know, like we didn't have a phone to call. So things were so different then. And I have lived that. So I can remember, it seems like yesterday, obviously, that I had my first daughter. So it's really incredible just to take that history and to put it into play.
Oh, I love it. I think it's so cool. And we're not going to talk about the details of the guide on this because it would just do a disservice to people because there's so many different levels of understanding the motions and when to do them and what's appropriate, how to assess where the baby even is initially before you begin the guide, et cetera. So if you're interested, you can take it. But just in case anybody's like, all right, when are they going to talk about it? We're not. So we're talking about all the other things instead. And so I have a couple of more pointed questions that are sort of random, but I just was dying to ask you. So I'm wondering if you're seeing any correlation between asynclitic babies or, you know, babies who are in the improper position, there may be ROA, ROT or something like that. And then those babies having oral ties, like tongue and lip ties, impeding their oral function, being tight babies, et cetera.
So I don't have anything specific in regards to the oral ties, but I do know that, and I have done research on, and I have a personal experience too, of anytime a baby is in utero, and particularly with the contractions compacting a fetus into a particular position, you have the risk of having a problem with the neck, with the face, with the head. Just think about that impact and how strong those contractions are. So that is another big reason for optimal fetal positioning, right? For to avoid birth trauma. We think about who are the risks, what is the contributing risk factors to those, what we call morbidities, fetal morbidities, such as nasal septal deformities, such as torticollis, which is the neck, such as anything related to the oral cavity. The risk factors are first-time moms, prolonged difficult labors, persistent occiput posterior babies, and instrumental deliveries, which means like a vacuum or forceps. So that puts you in that risk category. But in particular, babies' noses. When you have a fetus that is in an occiput, what we call persistent occiput posterior position, and this is something I most recently paid attention to, and I think we need to really go down this lane in regards to our pediatricians and our family practice docs and our providers that are taking care of neonates, is that we need to pay attention to the nasal cavities, because we know that 20% of neonates experience a difficult delivery that results in a deviation of their septum. And think about how neonates breathe. They're nasal breathers, right? They're nose breathers. And when you have a difficulty due to an anatomical deformity, that makes breathing harder. It makes feeding harder. It makes them uncomfortable, possibly relating it to a colic situation. 20% of babies have a deviated septum. And I don't remember ever looking at a baby's nose in the thousands of deliveries that I have actually experienced firsthand. So I really think that all of these ear tube problems, breastfeeding problems, dental misalignment, we know that it has a relation to that, and just overall poor general health could be fixed by, let's look at the nasal passage and let's maybe fix that deviated septum when they're a neonate, because the longer it goes on, as you know, as a clinician, the more opportunities there are for disease processes and complications. So any way that the baby's head is not coming through in a straight fashion and puts its facial structure or its bony structure of the skull up against another bony prominence for a long extended period of time, particularly with the pressure of the contraction pushing the other direction, there's a potential for harm.
Oh my gosh. So, you are blowing my mind right now, because this this is an area that I am constantly talking about, is all of the, you know, the myofunctional therapy, which is, you know, retraining the tongue or the recessed jaw, all
of the
breastfeeding. Yes, the craniosacral therapy, and how it seems like, what is going on where all these babies, and what, like, just to speak about my son, the long 36-hour posterior birth that I had with him.
Me too.
Yeah.
My middle one. Always nose problems, always crying, always dripping from her nose.
Yes. And he always had his mouth just hanging open. He was a mouth breather. And it matters. Absolutely. And sleep apnea. What I'm always telling my patients is that we do not want these kids to end up with sleep apnea, because there are so many different things that happen. I mean, you don't want them to end up with any of this, but like my son, we just had a cone beam scan, which is like a CT scan of the head, basically, because he's getting this palate expander. And I had no clue. They're like, oh yeah, he has a deviated septum. I'm like, what? I had no idea. And this is making so much sense to me because I was like, wow, how does this even begin? How does this happen? I never,
yeah, isn't
not
it
one time
incredible?
thought it could happen during birth. But babies are so squishy. All of the bones are so movable on purpose, as it should be. And things can happen in that time period where it's obviously not going to like necessarily really, really harm the baby, but it's all of these minor little anatomical things that when they come out and then they're not aligned, and if they maybe don't get any body work, then this contributes to low breastfeeding rates or to painful latches or to the misdiagnosis of tongue and lip tie when it's not necessarily that. It's something else going on. Maybe their jaw, and you know, it, maybe it's something where like the latch is off for sure. But if we can get a good craniosacral therapist to lay their hands on the baby and kind of reposition things. And yes, it takes several times. And a lot of people don't even know what craniosacral therapy is. I'm constantly talking about it because it has been life-changing for my children. They would not have been able to nurse had it not been for craniosacral therapy. I do think that my husband and I have bad genetics where together we do make tongue. Our babies are truly tongue and lip tied. And at the same time,
that's genetic. There's a strong genetic component. Yeah,
totally. And still they just, I think that it's almost like, I wish all babies were given the gift of a couple of sessions of craniosacral when they come out, even if they're C-section babies, because the C-section babies then don't get that compression, which is so important for their physiology. And so there's a lot of different reasons that this would be important,
correct.
But that is so fascinating that the positioning at birth. I mean, this is why as providers, we need to be always asking how was the birth and not just for the
the
woman's experience, which is totally important too, but what was the baby's experience and what was the baby enduring and how can that be? Like you said, with ear tubes. Oh my gosh, I get so frustrated with ear tubes in my practice because I feel like it's just adenoids, ear tubes.
If you were to start asking that question, which I ask everybody because I believe this wholeheartedly, is what was your biological mother's birth like? Because that makes a difference. Your question to your clients is, tell me about your birth. And the reason why I got interested in this was actually probably 22 years ago now when I took my then 7-year-old in for a TNA, tonsillectomy and adenoidectomy. And the ENT said, do you remember, I was standing right there. Do you remember what position you were born in? And I said, excuse me, what did you ask?
Yeah.
And he said, where were you facing up or were you facing down? And I said, excuse me, I'm a labor and delivery nurse and I have never, ever made that connection before. And so please tell me more. And then of course, now I understand when that nasal septum, for those of you on video, you think about this impact against that pubic symphysis for hours and hours and hours. And if you look, intravaginally, that's what it looks like. That pressure that's put on that septum, and possibly being in that position antenatally for weeks too. Because many babies are occipit posterior antenatally for weeks. And that's important to recognize and to pay attention to. And that's why that homework is so important.
Wow.
So yeah, I mean, we could talk forever about that. But it's like, it's another example of, the risks associated with a malposition and all of this, the medical sequelae that happens afterwards.
It's not just to prevent cesarean, it's to prevent a lot of different things because quote unquote, like our bodies would not be, we're not meant to be born that direction. We're meant to be born LOA and in this perfect kind of like tube down the chute path.
Yes,
there is other ways that we can come out, of course, and we can come out breech and,
there's
a lot of other things. And if we had to pick one that was the most ideal, it would be this way that we're discussing. Okay, that's so fascinating. Thank you for that. I'm going to be thinking about that all night long. So cool. Okay, I did have another question. What are your thoughts on membrane strips? And the reason why I ask is because I feel like a couple of years ago, there was a culture around membrane strips with midwives and home birth and natural birth community, physiological birth community, that it was very innocuous, very benign, not a big deal. Like, oh, a nice little way to just get things going or whatever. And now I feel like in the last couple of years, I've learned more and I'm a little bit surprised at, it seems like maybe it's not the best option, especially for a first time mom, and can cause this sort of erratic contraction pattern. That's maybe not all that conducive to labor, but
obviously, you know way more than I do. So I'm just curious about your thoughts in general. This maybe doesn't have to do with positioning, or maybe it does. What has been your experience of membrane strips and labor success?
It does have to do with positioning, and that's when it works the best. It works the best when the infant is in a good position on the cervix, and then you go and you take your, it's just like an exam. So it's a digital exam. If I were to do it, which I used to do it as a labor and delivery nurse, we would break waters and do membrane sweeping. We don't do that anymore, but I would insert my two fingers in and I would separate the amnion, which is the outer layer of the membrane, from the cervical tissue. So I would take my fingers and kind of sweep it along. It's not comfortable, obviously, and sometimes it's very uncomfortable due to the fact that the cervix can be way posterior, meaning I'm going to have to reach way back to get to that cervix in order to make it happen. And it is not without risk. The risks are breaking your water, obviously, because you're in there stimulating and breaking that membrane connection to the cervix. And so you're weakening that spot right there. You need to have consent. There are multiple cases of people having it done to them without consent, and that is not okay. That is a, Rebecca Decker actually says it's a human rights violation. And back to positioning, it works if you're a multip and your cervix is open a little bit and you are term and your body is ready to be going into labor and your fetus is ready to go into labor. So I always say that it's a combination of the fetal brain and the pregnant person's brain to go into labor. You need to be a cohesive little unit, just like you have been for 9 months to decide this is a good time for us to go into labor and to be born. And so if that's not happening and that Pitocin is not, or excuse me, that oxytocin is not being released from the fetal brain, then it's not time. And then physiologically, that needs to be working. And anatomically, the baby should be sitting in that position where it is on the, sitting on that cervix, such as a baby is when they're engaged, meaning zero station. So they're in the pelvis at that, at the ischial spines, and they're sitting on the cervix. Then, of course, if you think about it, you go in and you stimulate that. That's all you need to kind of kick into gear. But you're right when you're saying it does produce contractions, right? You release that prostaglandin pathway and you start contracting. And if your body's not ready, it's just going to create all these contractions. It's going to get in your mind too. And you're going to think, hey, I'm going to the labor, when you're not. You're just been stimulated to release that prostaglandin and oxytocin to contract, but your body and your baby aren't ready quite yet. And so there is very little evidence that it works unless your body's ready, your baby's ready, and the baby is sitting on the cervix.
Okay, this is really good.
So I say, don't do it. Better, let's get the baby in a good position, right? Let's think about getting the baby to the left side and then wait, because then that stimulation, when that fetal head is sitting on the cervix, as I talked in my seminar to you, was, you know, you're getting the baby prepared. The surfactant is increasing.
Yes.
The metabolism is increasing for the fetal system where they're regulating their sugars better. And then your cervix is getting more ripe. We call it ripe, which is kind of funny, where it's thinning, it's softening, it's coming more anterior, it's dilating. And then, of course, all of that is beneficial for labor, right? Baby's better prepared, your body's ready prepared. So rather than stripping membranes, let's pay attention to what is the position of the baby, how we can improve it. Antenatally, let's get the baby over to the left, tucking its chin and sitting on the cervix.
Yeah, this is just really highlighting how labor is not just a woman's cervix dilating, which is what everybody loves to say. And it's not just the baby being in the right position. And it's not just mom's body being ready. And it's not just any of these things. Like you just said, which I had forgotten from your seminar, when baby's head is on the cervix, the surfactant is a molecule that is released in the lungs to help prepare them to breathe in air. Then with blood sugar regulation, because baby's been regulated by the placenta all this time, and now they're going to have to do this on their own, that is like another step in the baby being ready to be born. And there's that just pressure that they're feeling on the back of their head is what stimulates all these physiological processes to be happening, to ready the baby, to ready the mom, to ready the entire system. It is not just pieces and parts. It all has to kind of work together. And we wonder why, when we just take one aspect of it, like give Pitocin, and then things don't work right. It's like, well, you're missing like so many pieces of the symphony. It's like, you're only hearing the violin or you're only hearing the bass. And it's like, how much different can it be if we would just allow it to wait? I mean, I'm trying to think of an analogy, you know, like if we, there's so many areas of life that humans love to manipulate. You know, I'm trying to think of like farmers growing fruit on a tree. Like you can pick the pear weeks before it's ripe, but it's not going to be as good as if you pick the pear off the tree ripe. It's just not going to, because it wasn't getting all of the different nutrients and stimulants from the tree to become the way that it was, etc. Or, you know, manipulation of the weather or whatever it is that we do. We're just always trying to mess and meddle with things and make them fit into our box and kind of feel like we have control over it. And this is honestly one of my reasons why I love birth so much, is because there's so much mystery to it. And there's so much we don't get to be a part of, right, and we don't get to like manipulate. And I know that's really hard for some people, especially scientific, you know, left-brained, medical, like I get it. Like, I understand. And everybody just needs to take a chill pill. What's the best outcome is if we can just get baby into the right position and then wait for the whole thing to happen. So I love that.
Yeah. Thank and how about much. The enjoyment we're getting when we sit back and just watch and what we learn? I mean, I'm an expert. Like, I've been doing this for a long time, but my favorite thing in the world is being what's called the second nurse, where I come in and I stand over at the warmer and I just watch. And of course I want to get in there and help, because there's oftentimes I want to do things different, but I don't. I stand back and I watch, and I'm like, and the other day my patient was delivering. I said, we got to get this baby out before I leave. Well, I left 11:30, baby was born at 11:31. Oh. So I I had given my report, but I stayed in there. And so my responsibility medically was done. I'd given report to the next nurse, who was completely awesome. And I stood back and I watched, and it's just like, are you kidding me? Like, this is the coolest thing that I could, I mean, how honored and blessed am I that I can watch birth. And I just wish that people would come back to that and just look at the glory, look at the magnificent process. And I try to tell my patients that it's like, please don't be fearful. Watch this incredible birth when this baby comes out, and the movements that the baby makes when it stretches its arm and tucks its chin and swallows the vaginal fluids. You know, they take that big swallow when they come out, and it's like, pay attention to this incredible process, because it is so beautiful. And and so that's what I try to do when I at every birth, is learn and observe. Yeah. And I wish more people would do that, because it's really incredible.
I love that. I wish I could be in your head and just quickly have all of the births that you've witnessed flash through before my eyes. I love births so much. It's such an amazing thing to be in a room and have a new human enter the room suddenly who wasn't there prior. You know, I mean, right. They were there, but right. They were under skin, and it's just not the same. And then now all of a sudden they're in the room, and it's like, holy crap, you guys, this is amazing. I love it. It's so cool. Okay. One quick other last question for you, because I feel like I hear about this pattern a lot, and you know, I've experienced it myself as sort of being the labor support person, or a doula, if you will. I'm not donor certified, but I just have helped several friends, and now I feel so much better equipped. And again, like I said, I was kicking myself about multiple things. A couple of the most recent births I've been to, I think would have ended up completely differently had I been, not like I'm taking it my personal responsibility, but I just think that I could have focused on fetal positioning. I'm sure that it was incorrect. And this is why, you know, they were long and hard and back labor and all of these things. Or then one of them ended up in cesarean as well for the arrest of dilatation, meaning that she didn't dilate past a certain point. And this is actually Dr. Leah. So the co-host on our podcast here, Healthy as a Mother, was planning a home birth, 42 weeks, had gotten multiple membrane strips, labor started, or quote unquote labor, you know, contractions had started. And it was like hot and fast and intense and heavy. And then for maybe like 2 hours, 3 hours. And we were like, holy crap, maybe this is happening. You know, and she was like 1 centimeter, 2 centimeters dilated or something like that. And then it like just really petered out, and the contractions spaced way out. And weren't as intense for another almost 2 days. And she never dilated more than 5 centimeters, was transferred to the hospital because of the 42-week rule in California. Waters broken, Pitocin epidural, never became more than 5 centimeters. And it was, now looking back, I'm sure that the baby was not in the right position. But aside from that particular story, necessarily, unless you have anything to say about it, what do you think is going on when there's these like stop, start, or kind of slowing? It's not maybe completely stopping. Is that just, is that baby's positioning, or why do you think that that happens?
Yes and yes.
Okay.
It is baby's position. And back to your co-host, this baby was direct OP. So I teach you in your seminar how to subjectively, in my seminars, subjectively and objectively determine or identify, we can't diagnose, whether or not the baby's malpositioned. And it's very, very evident when you have back labor that the baby's occiput posterior, the baby, the back of the baby's head is pushing on the actual sacrum, and that is what you're feeling. It's a highway of nerves under there. It's very uncomfortable physically. But I want to explain why things peter out. And you have another one that I identify as a sign is prodromal labor that is long and drawn out, because your body is recognizing that malposition and attempting to fix the position. So wow. There's things that you should do to help that. So the myometrium is the muscle of the uterus, and that is what contracts. It shortens, right? And it contracts, and then it lengthens again with a contraction. So that contraction shortening is runs vertically. So up and down. And you think about a baby that is in there sideways, asynclitic with its head or its body, or if it's turned occiput posterior, it can't wrap itself around properly the fetus within. And so it does this, what we call an irregular or tachysystole, which is too many contractions in a 10-minute period. So tachysystole or an irregular contraction pattern, or erratic, or how you said heavy, fast, intense, that kind of situation, I would immediately say baby's OP. Your body is trying to get that baby in a better position. Let's do some things to actually help the body get that baby. And the most important thing is you do it early, right? Because there's so much room abdominally for the baby to rotate versus once it gets in that bony pelvis, the space is more limited. So it's very typical of an occiput posterior baby. And then once it gets tired or the baby rotates, it takes a break and it slows down. And you then, of course, then we're saying, okay, give her some Pitocin. Her body can't do this, right? She has failed. So let's give her some Pitocin, the most abused drug in the obstetrics used, because we don't have the patience that we need in order for that body to kick in again. And what happens with when I go and I assist with a rotation, I went to a hospital recently and helped a young prima gravida who was having back labor. She was my client. And so I said, if you have any complications, call me, I'll come in. I went in, we did the guide. After we do the guide, I encourage them to lay on the left side for anywhere from 30 to 60 minutes. And so she's laying on her left side. And we have her on the monitor, of course, and I'm watching these beautiful contractions every 3 minutes. And I said, okay, I'm going to head out of here. I'm going to go out and wait for 30 minutes or so. And I said, you're contracting beautifully. And she's like, I'm contracting? And I said, yeah, every 3 minutes. She's like, that's a contraction? She was so cute. She's like, that I can handle. Like, that is a cervical, like, period. I'm so glad that pain in my back is gone. So she was able to handle that. And that's what I tell my clients is, if you get this baby in the optimal position, you will be able to handle it.
Yep.
But it's those malpositioning that are really, really hard to handle. And I can't blame them. They end up with an epidural the majority of the time. So that uterus gets tired. It regenerates. Okay, now I've got to think about reimagining my path of force, right? How I'm going to now effectively do what I'm meant to do and push this baby down. So from the top of your uterus is the fundus, and that is the pushing force. So now the baby's in this left occiput transverse, and there's this little butt up here, baby's butt, and it can just push down on the baby effectively and turn. And then the second thing is we starve our patients, yeah. Right? We absolutely starve the myometrium of its ability to contract. It needs energy. So that energy is in the form of glucose, right? So we take all of those opportunities out by making them NPO. It is not necessary that anybody be NPO during their labor. And
what
studies,
is NPO, just for the people who don't
know? Oh, I'm sorry. Nothing by mouth. Or even clear liquids. Now, but you can get creative with clear liquids at least. That bone broth, honey sticks, Gatorade, coconut water. I can get really creative with clear liquids. But when I'm told my patient can't have anything, that is like,
criminal.
It's just a sentence. It's a sentence to C-section. And the risks of eating during labor have no evidence base. Now, here's another big one for you to handle, is that evidence does not support NPO during labor. The practice is based solely on preference and tradition. It goes way back to 1949 when we had an aspiration case of a person in labor that was getting ether, right? That is nothing related to today's practice.
And everything's been set since that patient.
Nothing has changed since 1949. So we have to realize that it is so important to feed that. So if your nurse tells you you can't eat or drink during labor, and there's a policy when you get an epidural, you can only have clear liquids. You know, you can get creative with that. And that's why it's important to pack it in your labor bag. Pack honey sticks. They're amazing, like incredible, because it's kind of an oral fixation that you can suck, right?
Totally.
Sucking is really good during labor. Using your lips, your mouth is related to your pelvic floor. So when you're using your mouth to like suck on something, it's really cool. Bone broth, huge protein, you know, needs during your contraction process. So really, really get creative with that. But that is why things slow down, is because of the change of position of baby, uterine muscle gets tired, and we don't do it any favor by keeping that person starved.
Starved. Oh my gosh, this is it's so true. And it's so ridiculous when you really think about it. It would be like somebody running a marathon and being like, nope, sorry, you can't drink any water.
No water stations, no pee stations, because you can't empty your bladder. You know,
it's laughable when you think about it. It's honestly, and people, I love that you point out that the policy in hospitals has not changed since 1949, because erroneously, the average Joe Schmo couple is going into their birth thinking that the hospital is super cutting edge and is going to have the best, most up-to-date research and policies. And it's just not totally true. Everything takes a lot of time. And sometimes when there's not an impetus to change, then things just get stuck in their ways because there's so much to do. There's so many loops and administrative paperwork and everything to go through. We really need to be educated ourselves and say, okay, does that actually play out? And oftentimes it doesn't, like just even delayed cord clamping, which is, you know, now it's a really different culture than it was 15 years ago, but it took a long time for that to get
still
changed.
Not good enough though.
Yes.
30 seconds is not delayed cord clamping.
Right.
It is from where I've started. We used to clamp it immediately when the baby came out. Cord clamp came out and the placenta wasn't even delivered, obviously, but we would baby out, cord clamp immediately, like 5 seconds. Now it's 30 seconds at my hospital to 60 seconds if it's really delayed. No, 3 to 5 minutes. Who is that? Dr. Nichols, a dietitian. She did
Lily
a really
Nichols.
Great study. Lily Nichols, really great about what, again, all of the different things that happen medically if you just allow the benefits medically,
right.
If you allow it 3 to 5 minutes. So super
just
cool.
Allowing so much of this is just allowing the process
patience,
to happen.
Patience, right? Patience,
yes.
Belief. And my whole thing is belief in the body to do beautiful things. It's incredible. We have to get back to that, and we have to empower our birthing people because a lot of it's psyche, right? I can't do it unless you strip my membranes or give me Pitocin or break my water and give me an epidural. Yes, you can.
Yep. I love that.
Si se puede.
Yeah, yes, you can. And like you said too, I just want to reemphasize real quick that when the baby is in a better position, the contraction intensity is so much more manageable. And I did experience this now with two births where the baby was in the right position where I did not have back labor. Back labor is a certain kind of hell. Like that is a different gig. And yeah, you never really get a break either, because in between the contractions, you're still aching and uncomfortable and shaking, and your body is just like having this response because the baby is pushing up against nerves directly. And it doesn't have to be like that. It can be a very, very intense period contraction type pain.
Right.
And yeah, and so the seeking out of different medical pain relief would be way less if we were focusing on positioning. And if we were trying to get everything going with that, also just the speed at which the labors would go. Because I know that one big main thing that's, you know, everybody's very worried about with first time labors is fatiguing out and just being so tired because it lasts for so long. And yes, first labors are usually way longer than other labors. It's the first time your body's mm-hmm. done this. It's the first time your cervix is open like this. There's a lot of navigation and even just change to the shape of the uterus, like you were mentioning. And how many first-time moms are going in with the baby in the wrong position? And it just all takes so much more time than it needs. Mm-hmm. So yeah, thank you so much.
You're very good. We make a good team, Dr. Morgan.
I would love to work with you. It would be such a joy.
We make a great team. And and just explaining things, we do it very well together. And I honor you and your insistence on continue to get this information out. It's really important. And it's just not hard. But I want to say, like, we have to do it respectfully, right? Without yeah. throwing anybody under the bus.
100%.
Because when I talk at the medical schools, really, I say there's no dumb question. Like, I don't want to belittle you. You are incredible. Like, I cannot even thank you enough for saving that mom, my mom, the other day, right? Taking her back and getting that baby out efficiently and safely, right? But there are so many times when you could have done better. So mm-hmm. let's teach them in a way that's respectful and kind. They don't learn it in medical school. They do right. not learn the cardinal movements of the physiological birth in medical school. Maybe we need to start teaching, right? But there's other concentrations in other areas that are also of equal importance. But anybody we're teaching has to be done respectfully and kind. And that's kind of how my approach is that I have no judgment. Please learn and continue to learn. It is the way in which you improve on others is by constantly being a good listener and a good learner. And I thank you for bringing this up and for allowing me the opportunity to talk about all of this, because it's so incredible.
Oh my gosh, of course. Do. You're so welcome. And thank you for developing this and just having that extra step in you, the care and the awareness. You know, I'm sure this has taken you so many hours and up at night thinking about this. What is going on? How can we improve this? Did that position help? Did that position help? You know, then coming up with like a sort of a prototype of the guide and walking women through it and then being like, holy crap, this is working, you know, and how cool
holy
that
crap
is
what I say. Like, I can go in and say, I'm going to help you and we're going to get this baby to the left side. And then it works. And I'm like, oh my God, it worked again. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. It's magic, you know, and it's really incredible, and it's safe, right? And it's allowing the baby to move itself. There are people that still believe that this can't happen. There are the majority of people in OB think that this is not a thing. And yes. So we really got to get it across that the pregnant body can allow space for the smart neonate fetus to actually get in a better position. But we have to be proactive. We have to do it early because that makes a huge difference as far as the success rate. And then, like, don't let them labor for 4 days before you actually think about. I just taught at a hospital yesterday, and their main goal is we are going to make it a part of every nurse's first assessment, right along with the blood pressure, pain, admission process. Where is baby?
Oh,
I'm like,
whoa.
Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?
That made you so happy.
I was so happy. I was crying. It was just like, this should be everywhere. We have it on our chart, Morgan. We have a place for the baby's position on our Epic chart.
And nobody does it, really?
Nobody fills it in.
Okay. Wow.
Because
This is
they
so
don't
cool.
know how to,
Yes.
you know, but we need to teach people how to recognize it without rolling the ultrasound in.
Yeah, exactly. Like just going back to the old skills of palpation and how, or like you taught in the guide too, is getting the mother's body up so that you can look at it.
Yes.
In a way to see where is the lump? Is it on the left side, the right side? And what does that indicate? And, you know, all these different things. Also looking at the constellation of symptoms of the contraction pattern, the pain pattern, how long things have been going, how fast things are progressing, et cetera. And using all of this information to say, hey, okay, this is probably what's happening. We need to be like more investigative instead of sort of just, I don't even know. Like
and
I just,
asking the patient, right? And asking the patient, where is your baby's back? Do we ever do that?
Oh, yes, because mom
do
knows.
Do we ever ask the patient? Because mom knows. That pregnant person knows where that fetal back is 99% of the time, because that's my second thing. I look at the belly and then I ask the patient, where's
your
baby's
back?
That's
so cool. That's so sweet that
right?
you're connecting
and
with
bringing
the
that
baby.
Support person in, because then they get to be part of it too, decision, or not that decision, but that identification. So it's super cool to get that whole team effort and to get people involved.
Oh my gosh. I have loved this, Anne. Thank you so much for coming on, for sharing your wisdom with us. And what I, you know, we're going to be linking all of the links in the show notes here, but can you just tell people what's the best way to get in contact with you or work with you so that they can continue to follow your work and learn?
My Instagram is pretty fun. I do little drawings. It's called Gilligan's Guide. And then I talk about kind of a recent case or things that I have heard of. And then www.gilligansguide.com is my website. And I have my phone number on there. If you have a real need, and you can text me. I have taken texts from strangers about, I took one from Holland. She was in Holland the other day
Oh,
when I
wow.
was at the park. And she was going in for aversion and needed my advice. And I just kind of talked to her about how to relax and breathe. And it was incredible, successful aversion. So,
Yay!
yay.
That is such
But it,
a amazing thing that
yeah,
you offer
my
to
phone is
people.
always on. I don't know, maybe I shouldn't say that, but it is always on. And I do take, because of course we love birth so much. We never want to be
I
without
know.
it. So
It's like an
yeah.
addiction, honestly. There's
I
something wrong
know.
with my brain.
Definitely.
Okay.
But I'm lucky you're there with me. And thank you
Oh,
again
thank
for
you.
all you do. And I love your work too. So
oh, thank
take
you,
care,
Anne.
everybody.
Awesome. All right. Thank you, guys.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Healthiest Mother Podcast. In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and send to a friend who could benefit from this content. We're so excited to share more on becoming and being a mother next time.
And please remember that the ideas and views of this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to serve as a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis or treatment of any illness or disease. Consult with your provider before integrating this information into your own care plan. And remember, a healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.